from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. First day of autumn. Let's enjoy it. In a moment, confession of a serial killer. Wait till you hear this story. Here's what's happening. The family of a man shot and killed by a Charlotte, North Carolina police officer has called for the body and dashboard camera footage of the shooting to be made public as hundreds of protesters taking to the streets for a third consecutive night. There is a curfew. Police are not enforcing it as long as things stay peaceful, which they have been. The protests initially appeared to be peaceful, and they continue to be. The city's mayor and police imposed this midnight to 6 a.m. curfew. While the demonstrators chanted, "Release the tape," while briefly blocking an intersection near the Bank of America headquarters in the heart of the city's business district before moving on. Police have said that the man was shot to death by a black police officer after he disregarded loud, repeated warnings to drop the gun. Now, neighbors, though, say he was only holding a book. Police chief said a gun was found next to the dead man, but that the video was really inconclusive. You couldn't really see what was going on. A female Tulsa, Oklahoma police officer has been charged with first-degree manslaughter in the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man there. The Tulsa County District Attorney filed the charge against the officer, Betty Shelby, after viewing dash cam video and helicopter video of the September 16th shooting. Video from the shooting and its aftermath showed him walking away from the police officer with his arms in the air. The footage does not offer a clear view of when the police officer fired the single shot that killed him. Her attorney has said that he was not following police commands and that the police officer opened fire when the man began to reach into his SUV window. Yahoo has confirmed that hackers stole information from at least 500 million user accounts in what it describes as a state-sponsored attack. In a statement released Thursday, Yahoo's chief information security officer said the information was stolen from the company's network back a couple years ago. The account information may have included names, email addresses, telephone numbers, dates of birth, hashed passwords, encrypted and otherwise, and security questions. And also, with the recent survey suggesting a good many people find it hard to resist popping a found USB stick into their computer to figure out what it is, it's no surprise that hackers are now using them to try to spread the malware. Cops in Australia reported this week that a number of the storage devices have been left in mailboxes of residents who then go and get them and put them in their computers. Lauren Weinstein, an expert on all things technical, with us. Lauren, first the Yahoo story. Why did it take them 2 years to tell us about it?
Yeah, it isn't clear. Stories about this were coming out some time ago. Back then, it was the rumor was it was only 200 million.
now it's 500.
Now it's half a billion, yeah. This is starting to get a Groundhog Day kind of aspect to it. We see this happening again and again. Whether or not it's really state-sponsored that went after it or not, you know, you can speculate, you can make guesses, but it's so easy for groups to obscure their origins one way or another. What's interesting is in this massive information that apparently is was exposed, and this is anybody who had a Yahoo account, starting about in the period of about 2014 or so, email addresses, phone numbers, that's not awful. Birth dates, that's bad because you tend to use that as a low grade security information. But the passwords are hashed, and whether or not they can be cracked, we just don't know. We don't know what the strength is of the hashing algorithms that were in use, but it does mean it's really important that people not share passwords. The way you get into trouble in these situations is when you use the same password at a lot of different services.
That's right.
One of them is compromised, a whole bunch of them that you use are compromised. What's really kind of nasty in this is the security questions being exposed, because security questions are just bad news. Google has pretty much stopped using them entirely. They don't really offer any security, and if you answer them honestly, which I actually don't recommend, and you answer the same kinds of questions at different sites, you're just opening yourself up to attack, because let's face it, it's not that hard to find out what your first school was, maybe you posted about your first pet. Just security questions are bad. If you have to use them, don't answer them honestly. Keep track of how you answer them, but don't really put down what your school is or your first girlfriend or your favorite color and all that kind of thing. All right, use USB sticks.
This is now in Australia. They're putting them in mailboxes. People go in their mailboxes. They see, oh, look what I got, and they take it and they put it in their computer.
Yeah, this is an old ploy. In some situations, there have been people who have planted basically just bowls of USB sticks at security conferences where all the security professionals are, and hoping that people will just grab them and stick them into their computers. But you remember the old Roman saying, right? Beware strangers bearing USB flash drives. If you don't know absolutely 100% where a flash drive came from, and you don't completely trust that source, you can't even risk putting it into your computer to look at it, because the very act of plugging it in there, even if you don't access it from any software, could contaminate your computer.
Jeez.
Now, here's something even worse.
Uh-oh.
There are some specially...
Hearing it first. Here we go.
Specially designed USB flash devices now that not only can spread malware, they can actually burn, actually physically, electrically burn out your USB circuitry on your computer. They've got capacitors in them. They're absolutely evil and designed to do as much physical destruction as possible. Moral... Don't plug in those USB sticks if you don't know where they came from.
You got it. Okay, thanks, Lauren. Stay in touch. I love your work. A North Texas woman says she has conceived her third set of twins naturally, rounding out her family of 10. There's not much more I can say about that story. Third set of naturally conceived twins. Wow. Physicist Stephen Hawking is again warning about announcing our presence to any alien civilizations that might be out there, especially those that could be more technologically advanced. He says, be careful. You never know what's going to happen. I tell you what, though, with Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center, you always know what's going to happen. Great reports of weekly updates. What do we have, Peter?
And this is a really interesting week, George. I'd love to sit down and talk with Stephen Hawking, because I think they're here. I don't think they're out there. But a bunch of really interesting reports, and I'll close with a report of sighting just north of Philadelphia less than 4 hours ago. But I start with a report from Monday, the 5th of September, Labor Day Monday, Labor Day weekend. St. George, Utah, a woman lives about 40 miles outside St. George. That Monday night, she and her son went to bed in their house, and they were very soon after awakened by a very loud buzzing sound that seemed to be coming from the south of them. She looked out an east-facing window in time to see an isosceles triangle-shaped ship, dark in color, probably black, with two green lights in the nose of it and yellow lights on the trailing apices of the triangle. Very, very dramatic sighting. They heard it and saw it for about 15 seconds. She said she's never seen anything like it. It's worth reading that report. It's a good one. 5 days later, the 10th of September, that's a Saturday morning, three adult females were driving back from the Savannah, Georgia airport to the community of Hilton Head, South Carolina. They were driving by a golf course. They saw what they thought was a meteor in the night sky. They said, oh, a sign of good luck, and they all wished, made wishes. A few seconds later, probably a quarter of a mile down the road, a ball of light, intensely bright, streaked across the hood of their automobile. They estimate, all three of them estimate it was within 3 feet of the windscreen of the automobile, illuminated the interior of their car with a brilliantly bright white light. The object streaked to their left and covered the fairway of a local golf course. Very interesting sighting. I've received three of those reports. One of them is posted. I just checked it. It's posted for the wrong date, but the correct date is the 10th of September, Saturday morning, 12 days ago, I guess. Another sighting of a triangle from Farmington, Maine. This is on the 15th of September, a week ago tonight. Gentleman was standing in line to return an item he'd purchased from a store there, he saw a yellow, distinctly yellow diamond-shaped craft descend out of the night sky. I encourage people to read that report. Very interesting. 2 hours later, a similar sighting of a brightly lighted sphere in Bear, Delaware, Newcastle County. Guy writes very well. I suspect he's an excellent witness. Very interesting report, and he was shaken to the roots of his soul by what he had seen. He tried to pursue it and take a photograph of it, but it disappeared before he could do it. About 2 hours later, a gentleman was driving near Canby, Oregon. That's about 10 miles south of downtown Portland, Oregon, saw two yellow lights skirting their way across very low altitude across a farmer's field. He sat and watched them and was just absolutely shocked by what he was looking at. And finally, report from Philadelphia tonight. In fact, the city of Glenside, north of downtown Philadelphia. I should send this report to Dr. David Jacobs. I think he'll enjoy this one. Young woman in her 20s, a graduate student, was returning from a birthday party with her boyfriend, and he said, "What's that?" And she was sitting in the back seat because the front seat was filled with boxes from a birthday party. She looked out the side window, George, and she saw a huge black dark triangle hovering motionless in the sky with an intensely bright light radiating from the nose of that craft. We should have that report posted in sometime over the weekend, I hope. But lots and lots of things going on, and if people are inclined to read some of these reports, I urge them to do so. There's some excellent reports posted to our website this week.
Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center. Way back in 1974, Dennis Rader stalked, murdered four family members in Wichita, Kansas, and so began his serial killing life. In a moment, we will talk with Catherine Ramsland, Ph.D., Confession of a Serial Killer on Coast to Coast AM. Dennis Rader is an American serial killer who murdered 10 people in Sedgwick County, Kansas, between 1974 and 1991. He's the one known as the BTK killer. Stands for Bind, Torture, Kill. Now, that was his very infamous signature. He sent letters describing the details of the killings to police and local news outlets during the interval when the murders happened. After a hiatus in the 1990s to the early 2000s, he resumed sending letters in 2004, leading to his 2005 arrest and subsequent guilty plea.
All right, Mr. Rader, I need to find out more information. On that particular day, the 15th day of January, 1974, can you tell me where you went to kill Mr. Joseph Otero?
I think it's 1834, Edgemore.
All right. Can you tell me approximately what time of day you went there?
Somewhere between 7 and 7:30.
This particular location, did you know these people?
No, that's, that was part of my, my what you call fantasy. These people were selected.
All right, so you...
Okay.
You were engaged in some kind of fantasy during this period of time?
Yes, sir.
All right. Now, when you use the term fantasy, is this something you were doing for your personal pleasure?
Sexual fantasy, sir.
I see. So you went to this residence, and what occurred then?
Well, I had did some thinking on what I was going to do to either Mrs. Otero or Josephine, and basically broke into the house, or didn't break into the house, but when they came out of the house, I came in and confronted the family, and then we went from there.
What you're about to hear is the incredible story of Dennis Rader, Confession of a Serial Killer. Now, Dr. Catherine Ramsland directs the Criminal Justice Master's Program at DeSales University in Pittsburgh, where she also teaches forensic psychology. Now, with extensive knowledge about extreme offenders, she has published 58 books, including the mind of the murderer, the human predator, the devil's dozen, and so many more. And here she is on Coast to Coast. What an incredible story and great book, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
I have been fascinated with these stories for years, and to watch these unfold right before our eyes, truly amazing. How did you get interested in this, especially the Dennis Rader case?
Well, the Dennis, I actually teach a course on serial murder, so I've been doing this for quite a few years. I've been studying serial killers, and I used to write for the Court TV website. I did quite a few cases for them. But the Rader case was a strange serendipity for me. What happened was that when he was arrested, a woman started corresponding with him, and she wanted to write a book. She encouraged him to join with her to write his story. And there were books out there, but they were mostly about the investigation, and this was going to be from his point of view. But after about 5 years, she just found that she couldn't keep up with it. And I happened to see her on Facebook, and I asked her whatever happened to her book, and she asked me if I would take it over. So that is a very strange way of entering into something
sure
like
is.
This, but that's what happened.
Is Rader different from most psychologies of serial killers? I mean, was he like a Ted Bundy, for example, or a Edward Gein? I think he was different, wasn't he?
Well, they're all different. In my world, there's a great deal of diversity.
Yeah.
They don't get generalized and thrown into. There's no such thing as a profile of a serial killer. Rader was interesting in that he studied other serial killers pretty intensely to come up with his MO and what he wanted to do. When he was a teenager, he was quite aroused by some stories in True Detective magazines, including Harvey Glattman, who had lured victims with the promise of being on the front page of True Detective magazine because he was a photographer. When he bound them, then he would get pictures of them being terrified by him telling them that now he was going to kill them for real. And those images were seared into Rader's mind. As a teenager, he found that highly exciting. Then he read about H.H. Holmes and found the whole idea of the three-story hotel with all the torture devices also very exciting. So he began to actually study what other serial killers did, probably more intensely than is typical of a serial killer today. And that really does set him apart. But so does the fact that he lived a completely ordinary life as a family man. He had kids, he had a wife, he was president of his church congregation, he had a full-time job. This is not something you typically expect.
Really a dual personality, truly.
So much so, yeah.
Now, he was almost 29 when he first started his rampage of killing. You know, he was 28, he was going to be 29 a couple months later.
Yeah.
What was the catalyst? What was the trigger, in your opinion, that got him going?
Well, he says that it was being laid off from a job that he really wanted and being very angry. He broke into a house. He tried a kidnapping, which didn't go well. But he just wanted to get to feel like he was in control of something. But I would say that's probably not really where it started, because he was already stalking people. He was looking into windows. He had a hit kit made up already. It's possible that this is not the starting point. But he certainly had been thinking about the idea that he could be one of the elite serial killers long before the age of 29.
We'll talk about his mistake and how he got caught, but how was he able to, Catherine, have this dual life where he was this heinous serial killer and then he was this wonderful family man that everybody seemed to like?
Well, I wouldn't say everybody seemed to like him.
Well, not everybody.
I definitely hear stories of people who didn't like him at all. But certainly he was a good neighbor. He was, you know, very involved in his church. People did like him there. His kids didn't have any idea. His wife didn't have any idea. But he did this thing that we in psychology call compartmentalizing, which other killers like Ted Bundy did very well. But Rader has a particular word for it that I like. Called cubing. He calls it cubing. So he thinks of himself as a cube with multiple sides, and he can actually live on one side without seeing the others. And so when he's a killer, he's living on that That's
well, he did a great job of balancing for a while. Stay with us, Catherine. We're going to hit a break and come back. We'll talk more about your work, Confession of a Serial Killer. And the next hour, we will open up the phone lines. Later on tonight, Dr. Michael Sala joins us to talk about the secret space program and some contact. We're going to get his reaction to physicist Stephen Hawking, too, who is saying, don't let ETs know we're here. Please. We're going to get his take on that. We're going to come back in a moment with Catherine Ramsland as we talk about her work, Confession of a Serial Killer, The Untold Story of Dennis Rader, the BTK Killer. Okay, welcome back to Coast as we chat with Dr. Catherine Ramsland as we talk about her book, Confessions of a Serial Killer, Confession of a Serial Killer. And Catherine, we're talking about Dennis Rader and how he was able to balance his life. At any point, did anybody who knew him suspect him of doing this?
There was no point, at least that anyone has admitted. There were some times when he thought he might have gotten caught, but nobody really suspected a thing.
In the course of what he was doing, and he killed 10 people that we know of, that he confessed to, there was a block of time where he stopped. You know, because he went from 74 to 86, and then 91. there was a 5-year break, and then he jumped to 91. Why did he seem to stop?
He didn't stop. He failed.
Aha!
That's a different.
Aha!
Different. He describes it as like being a fisherman who goes out, and sometimes he gets the big catch, and sometimes he comes home with nothing. And he was out stalking people. He actually sent me a list of his, what he called his projects. There were 55 people on that list, and they spanned all the years. And he already was targeting another victim when the police caught him. So he didn't really stop.
In his court appearance, he said this was his fantasy, and he seemed to allude it was a sexual fantasy. Would you agree with that?
I think it's a mix of a couple of things. The sexual fantasy is what drove the addiction, but also the idea of being famous was a very, very important part of this because he wanted to be...
There are other ways to be famous.
Well, no, he wanted to be a famous, like an elite serial killer like Jack the Ripper and Ted Bundy and Son of Sam. He wanted that kind of fame.
Did he get it, in your opinion?
I don't know if he's gotten quite, certainly hasn't gotten the Jack the Ripper status, but he's certainly become famous, yes.
Did you meet with him?
Yes.
What did you think? And did you feel a little uneasy meeting? See, you've got experience doing this.
Yeah, it's not the same for me because he's not the first serial killer I've spoken to, but in a maximum security prison, you don't really meet face to face. There's not even, it's monitors. So you're pretty buffered from
okay.
them. We talk on the phone a lot, and that's much more intimate than any meeting in the prison.
In your opinion, was he above board? Was he honest with you?
I think he was trying to be honest. There certainly were times that caught him in lies, and then he would say things like, well, I'm talking about how I am now, not how I was. Like, he'd talk about being a good person who did some bad things. And, you know, I gave him a few psychiatric tests and whatnot, and he would answer in a way when I'd say, I know you're lying, I know this isn't true, and he'd say, it's true of me now.
If he were released today, and he won't be, but if he were, would he go back and kill?
Hard to say because he's 70. Often that addiction wears off as they age. I don't know that he would, but I think he'd be thinking about it.
Any remorse there?
It depends on what part of the cube you're on any given day. he'll talk about that, but then the next day he might be all excited about drawing his torture silo or, you know. So I think the remorse is fleeting. How deep it is, I don't know, but I don't know how deep it would be for anybody who says they have remorse.
For a serial killer, he killed 8 females, 2 males. That's a little unusual, isn't it?
Well, he didn't actually intend to kill Mr. Otero.
And the son, right?
And the son. The son he thought might be in the house, and he thought that wasn't really his target.
I mean, the kid was 9. He killed a 9-year-old
Yeah, and that was more for him collateral damage. Just he's in the way. but he wasn't a target. The father happened to be home. Raider didn't expect him to be there. So again, not a target. So he never did target males, even though he did kill two. And attempted to kill another one.
Catherine, because of your experience, I want to tap into your expertise for a second. What happens to these people to want them to go ahead and kill and do things like that?
Each one has their own particular trajectory, but a lot of it, some of them have been abused. Raider wasn't. Some of them have been exposed to violence in their families. Some have a neurological disorder. Some are psychotic. I mean, there's all different kinds of motives and ways to getting into this. And not everybody's motivated by sexual fantasies. So those who are tend to have more of an addictive quality to what they're doing. And they may get there because they developed a certain paraphilia that's violent. They get aroused to violent images like Raider did to women, particularly being bound. He used to draw girl traps when he was an adolescent. He dreamed about girls being tied to the railroad track. That aroused him. So the more he indulged in those fantasies, the more he wanted to act it out. And that you find that to be very common with serial killers who are sexually motivated.
If you MRI'd his brain and other serial killers' brains, what would you see? Any abnormalities?
Well, we do see, in psychopaths, we do see abnormalities with fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, but that we don't know that that's present in all serial killers. We know we are certainly finding it in psychopaths, but not all serial killers are psychopaths. If Brader's a psychopath, probably there would be some brain evidence of, you know, the same thing we're finding in other psychopaths. But he also was dropped on his head as a kid.
He was.
Yeah, and his mother also fell off a horse when she was pregnant with him, and he got in a car accident when he was a teenager that had involved a head injury. So it is possible he does have some brain damage.
He used to torture animals as a kid. I've always been told that's a clear-cut sign of some kind of possibility of a problem.
Well, there's one problem with that is this idea of the McDonald triad, which is animal cruelty, fire setting, and bedwetting. And there's actually no research evidence for those three signals of, you know, developing into a serial killer later in life. But animal cruelty is an indication of lack of respect for life, the need for power over weaker things. No sense of it. Of a sentient creature, it wasn't all animals. He hanged barn cats, and part of that was something he got from his grandmother. She didn't like the cats around either, so he just didn't like the cats because they were mysterious and they reminded him of girls, which made him really uncomfortable. And so, yeah, he would hang cats in the barn.
His wife of 34 years divorced him. He has two children. Do they have anything to do with him?
His daughter has made some attempts, but she actually did read the book, and there have been a few articles, interviews with her in the Wichita Eagle, which is the hometown where she was raised, that indicate she's just so appalled and so of this stranger. This is not the man she knew as her father at all, the things that she's read in these pages, and it's really difficult for her. She's made some attempts. His wife and his son have nothing to do with him.
Has she read the book?
I know the daughter did. I'm sure the wife.
No, has Dennis read it?
Oh, he can't. It's contraband.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, he can't have it in prison. Now, I suspect
he can't have this book or any book.
He can't have books about serial killers. Although, weirdly, in their library are books, they're novels about serial killers, and he has read some of those. Like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo and things like that. He reads that, but he's not allowed to have these nonfiction.
Is he in isolation or is he with other inmates?
He's in a maximum security. He's in his own room, yeah.
And he stays there?
Yeah, it's pretty 24/7, but he is so busy. He has so many correspondences and he plays chess with a lot of people. He's quite busy. He's always, it's so weird to think about somebody who's sitting in a you know, a cell all day as being busy, but he is.
Did he ever break down and cry or tell you that, you know, he ruined his life? Or is there anything like that?
He has certainly expressed regret over ruining his life. I don't even imagine him crying because he's achieved one of his greatest goals, which is to become a famous serial killer.
Yes. And what about the 10 people he killed? Does he have any kind of guilt about that?
No, they were pawns in his game. He had ownership of them. Once he targeted them, they became his. Or any of the victims' families. And he did sign over the media rights to his life to the victims' family trusts, and so they get the proceeds of this book, most of the proceeds of this book. And so that's his redeeming thing. He thinks because they might earn some money from his life story, he's redeemed himself.
Catherine, at any given time, how many serial killers do you think are wandering around the United States?
Maybe 15 to 20. And it's not the myth of, you know, 50 to 100.
Which is a number I've always heard.
Well, that's a lie. That was a lie that was made up to scare Congress into funding the program.
Huh. Well, of these 15 to 20, how many do you think they've killed? What's the range?
It's not possible to say.
You can't say.
I know there have been guesses, but it's really not possible to say.
Most of them are men, right?
Most are men, but we certainly have females. We have a lot of team killers. About 20% kill in teams. Some of those are male-female. Some are female-female. Some are male-male. You know, 2, 3, 4, 5 people all together. So, but most are lone men, yes.
What surprised you the most about Dennis Rader, if anything?
Yeah, nothing really surprised me. He put the challenge to me of solving what he called Factor X. He liked to think there's a big mystery in how he became what he was. I didn't think there was much mystery once I really got immersed in his life story. And, I mean, he wrote thousands of pages for me, and I spent a lot of time on the phone with him. And in the end, I didn't think it was much of a mystery, but on the other hand, that's what I study all day.
Yeah.
So to many people, it remains a mystery, but not to me. And one of the reasons I wanted to write this book was to make a contribution to the field of criminology and forensic psychology.
He was in the Air Force for 4 years. Any signs of problems there?
Yeah, he had a hit kit when he was, and he had fantasies.
What's a hit kit?
A hit kit is what serial killers put together in preparation, so they carry it around in a car or in a briefcase. Something they, if they see an opportunity, they'll have their ropes and their
clubs and everything else.
Whatever they use, they'll have it ready.
Most of the killings, the 10, were they done inside these people's homes?
All of them were.
All of them. So that was one of his M.O.s.
Yes.
He'd break in.
He'd usually cut the phone line. Now, obviously, these days, nobody even...
You don't, yeah, most people don't have phone lines.
So he cut the phone line. That was one of his favorite MOs. He might go in through a basement window, or he'd cut out a window. And in one case, he just threw a big concrete block through the window because he knew it was an isolated house and no one was going to hear. But he'd enter somehow. Often he'd go in, he'd watch their routines, he'd go in and wait until they came home to surprise them. He'd sit in their closet till they came in the bedroom. Very creepy. It really is the nightmare.
It is a nightmare.
Can you imagine?
Yeah. Yeah. And his main method of killing was strangulation, right?
Yeah, because he liked the binding. That was what aroused him the most, is the feeling of control. And he had to tie them up because he needed the rope or twine or whatever he used to bind them, because that was a big part of it, and then he would strangle them.
Did he ever get to a point where he let someone go?
Well, he did inadvertently let someone go. He tried killing Catherine Bright's brother. He didn't expect him to come in, Kevin Bright. He shot him twice, but Kevin managed to get up and run, and so he accidentally let him go. But he didn't let someone go out of you know, courtesy or because he felt mercy. That never happened. There were times when he waited for someone in their house and they didn't come home. There were quite a few times like that.
And he left.
So he left because he had things to do.
But he never came back?
No. If one house didn't work out, he'd go stalk another one. Like I said, he gave me this list of 55 projects with names, addresses, dates. I mean, very clear.
He was ready to go.
Very, very ready to go. He, at one place, he had dug a grave, and he was going to kidnap the woman and take her out to a barn and then bury in a grave, you know, because he wanted to do something different.
How did he find them, Catherine?
Just watching for opportunities. He did work for a security company for a while, installing alarms, which gave him an opportunity, first of all, to know what they used, also to see the layout of their house, to see if they were alone, see if they had a guard dog.
He killed some of the people who he put alarms in their house?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Or stole from them. He stole from a lot of people.
What do you mean he stole from them?
He'd go into their houses.
As like a robber?
Yeah, not money. He'd take women's underwear mostly, or you know, just little items, just to make it feel as if he had control of them.
How did he get caught?
He got caught because someone was writing a 30-year retrospective, which sort of brought him out of, like, he didn't like that somebody was writing his story.
He wanted to write it.
Probably. And also they only knew about 7 of the victims. They didn't know about 3 more. And so he knew this person wasn't going to write the whole story. So he decided to start sending police and newspapers and television stations, you know, some notes and letters. Part of it was he was trying to get rid of some of the victim items because he was beginning to worry that eventually they were going to get found. So he was going to shed them. And he thought this would be a great opportunity to get rid of items and also reemerge as BTK and make people afraid of him again in Wichita. So he started writing what he called his cat and mouse letters. And this lasted for almost a year. Along the way, he made a mistake by what he would do with his letters was he would copy them from one machine to another so nobody could trace him to a particular copy machine.
All right.
So he asked the police he knew how to use a computer. If I use a computer disk, can you trace me?
He asked them this?
He asked them that, and they said no.
Ha-ha. You mean he actually, what, he wrote a letter to the cops, or how did
And he said, place an ad in the newspaper letting me know that it's okay, because he loved the codes, and he loved all the spy kind of communication.
So they lied to him.
So they lied to him, and they got him.
They got him that way.
That way. The disk he had used in a church computer, so the imprint was there. His name was on it because he had used it to type up some church notes. He didn't have his last name on, but Dennis.
That's all they needed, but they knew the church, right?
They went to the pastor and said, do you have Dennis in your congregation?
Oh, my God.
And then they got DNA from the daughter's medical files.
Technology got him.
Yeah, yes.
What an amazing story. And do you continue to interview these kinds of people?
Yes.
I mean, who's next for you?
Well, I don't know. I'm not going to do this. Is a 5-year project. I am not going to do this again.
This was intense, wasn't it?
This is intense. And I had just written a book called The Mind of a Murderer, where I looked at, in the past 100 years, how many mental health experts have done this. And I found about a dozen cases, which isn't very many in 100 years, but I used them as my role model, because after I published that book, I got this opportunity, and it was like, okay, here it is.
All right, Catherine, we're going to come back and take phone calls from a lot of folks who are very interested in what you do. Plus, if anybody happened to have known Dennis Rader from Kansas, maybe you met him, definitely call us.